This is at once a very easy kind of presentation to do, but also a little bit annoyingly difficult. It's easy because all you have to do is go to the internet and type in how to make a multiple choice test, and you will find literally hundreds of actually very good sources. And of course, that's what makes it also difficult, is there's so many different little things that people say. So what I'd like to do today is spend a little time on all those little bits and pieces, but not too much, because as I said, a quick search on the internet will find you repetitive versions of them. Almost every university that has a teaching faculty development program will have on their website something about writing multiple choice tests. Duquesne has a really good one. UT Austin has a decent one. There are hundreds. So I thought the first thing we really should do, though, is to frame all those details with a few big ideas that I think provide guidance in knowing which details and which small things to actually worry about and pay attention to. So we'll spend the first little bit talking about those big ideas. Then I have a list of things to do and not to do. And then we conclude with a somewhat repetitive, but I think important list about writing distractors. So the first thing we really need to do in order to think about what it means to write a good multiple choice test is define what a good multiple choice item is. What are the characteristics of a good multiple choice item? So the first thing is that it has an appropriate level of difficulty. Item difficulty just really means what percent of the class got it correct. And the more that got it correct, the less difficult it was, and so on. But this is an important point because it's really not practical to give a multiple choice test full of items that only a very few people get, because then your test scores are very low, and that has all kinds of collateral effects, none of which are actually good. I remember when I first was at Texas A&M, the chemistry department there, of course, it was filled in those freshman level courses with pre-med and pre-dent, and all of whom were extremely bright, very competitive. And the average exam scores on those freshman chemistry exams would be in the range of 26, 27, 28 out of 100. And of course, that was a source of huge problems for everybody. And you can say, well, all right, but if it's just too difficult, then I'll just curve the grades. But that actually, curving grades is actually a very suspect process. What it actually means is either the students don't know anything, or the teacher doesn't know how to make a test, or both. And you don't know which is which. So difficulty is an important component. Probably more important than difficulty is discrimination. Discrimination basically means, did the students who scored high on the test overall get this item correct? And so you want items of whatever difficulty, and difficulty is unrelated to this, except at the extremes, you want items that students who scored well on the test overall get correct, but students who did poorly on the test overall get wrong. Face validity. Face validity just means, to the taker of the test, does it look like that's a fair item? Does it look like that's an appropriate item? So there are four key ideas, I think, that bound the thinking about what makes good multiple choice items. The first one is to to appreciate the cognitive process and the notion of cognitive load. What we want the student to do when he or she reads the test item is to understand the test item and be able to retrieve the appropriate answer. And we don't want them to have to engage in any other kinds of cognitive gymnastics to get to do that task. So questions that are unduly complex, questions that have multiple negatives in them, questions that use vocabulary that's different from the vocabulary the student is accustomed to using in the course. These are all things that increase the cognitive load of the test. And so we spend a lot of time talking about cognitive load in designing instruction so that we don't design a lesson so that it is unnecessarily difficult to learn for reasons unrelated to what's being learned. But the same concept applies to multiple choice items. Multiple choice items impose a certain cognitive load, and we want to be sure as we write them that we don't inject into that extraneous or unnecessary load that interferes with the student's ability to actually answer what we really wanted them to answer. So cognitive load is an important concept in understanding writing good items. And many of the specific do's and don'ts, although most lists of do's and don'ts, actually I didn't find, I spent quite a lot of time looking at all those websites and looking at all those lists, I didn't see any of them that actually give you a conceptual framework for why you would do this or that, other than just it makes sense, common sense. But one of the main reasons is cognitive load. Second thing is test wiseness. Test wiseness is a person's ability to understand the non-content related cues that are in a test and to answer questions correctly because they understand the semantics of the question asking and not necessarily the content of the question. There are, as we were talking earlier, many, many people who do courses on test wiseness. It's a key part of any SAT or GRE type test preparation. There are two problems with test wiseness. The first one, obviously, is that it's not students who have high levels of test wiseness will score high on the test without actually knowing the answers to the questions. So this is an enemy of good assessment from the perspective that you get high test scores in the absence of knowledge. The second notion of the second problem with test wiseness is related to this additional point, and that is that it is very clear that test wiseness is related to many socioeconomic, cultural, and language irrelevant points to people knowing the content. So it's very clear that test wiseness is related to socioeconomic status, it's related to educational experience. I don't know that there's a particular study on this, but I would be extremely surprised if it wasn't related to things like being first generation college student in your family. And certainly it has all kinds of problems in terms of cross-cultural issues for international students. Because these cues that are in that are the basis of test wiseness are very, very experience focused. And that experience is a very white, upper and middle class educated experience. So part of the test being a just test is that it avoids measuring things or injecting points into a score that are not based on knowledge, but are based on these other irrelevant issues. The other concept of the just test is then related to this last point, which is there is a real tendency for multiple choice tests given in the real world to be just completely disconnected from the total learning package that the student is presented with. This has largely to do with the fact that in large general education courses where textbooks are heavily marketed, every textbook has hundreds of test items, so we'll talk about test banks in a minute, but what the professor chose to focus on in terms of learning objectives could be and often is quite detached from the items that are in the test bank. The test bank was not written to your course outcomes. And so another aspect of the just test is that it is a test. A test should be, the item should be, on what the teacher has told students they should know. And that may or may not be the content of the items in a test. And so to the extent that an item is random and not related to a learning objective that the professor has emphasized, I think we'd call that an unjust item. So the test items really cannot be assessed outside of understanding their place in the total learning package. Test items need to reflect learning objectives, and to the extent that they don't, then they're not part of the total learning package and actually create quite a lot of distraction from the total learning package. Because once students get the idea from a multiple choice test that you're just asking random things and not the things you've emphasized, they'll just stop looking at both of them because there's really no sense for them of how to predict what might be on the test. And so they'll try to use their test wiseness skills or hope for the best rather than actually studying. So you very much discourage studying when you do that. So one thing I really want to emphasize here is we'll go back to the concept of test wiseness. Test wiseness probably is associated with intelligence in a sort of raw sense. But I think sometimes teachers mistake students being able to answer questions that are difficult because they can figure out the question with the question assessing higher order thinking about the content. And those are completely different things. So that's a thing not to be confused. Okay, so we basically have two things. We have teacher-made tests and we have test banks. Now, there's actually a third category of test items out there that are professionally written and scientifically tested. And those are the kinds of test items that are on things like the SAT and the GRE and the MCAT and all those. Obviously, each one of those items costs several thousand dollars to develop. In terms of time, in terms of the talent that goes into it, in terms of pretesting it, and so on. So although that process might be our model for how we'd like it to be, I don't think in our world we're going to have exams like that. So we're going to have to live with what we have. It is no surprise to anybody that teacher-made tests on the criteria that I gave you earlier, difficulty, discrimination, and face validity, teacher-made tests or rank somewhere between awful and horrible. There are lots of studies of teacher-made tests. Basically, the finding is that half of the items on the average teacher-made test are completely worthless. They are of no value whatsoever. And yet, most of our students are taking, many of our students are taking teacher-made tests. And so when we understand what goes into the teacher-made test, it's just making sausage. Because you have to think about what the factors are that lead to teachers making tests the way they do. And the primary one that you have to be aware of is that it takes a lot of time and they don't put time into it. So even if teachers actually knew all of these things, the fact that they actually have time to make test items that fit these criteria is pretty unrealistic in some ways. in Canvas, we get a good quiz, or we get something on paper, and it's all nicely and neatly formatted. The process that went into making that item, it's not something we really want to know. It's really not a very good process. The test banks present us with another kind of problem. Not unlike that problem. The problem may be more obscured, and that is that test banks are written as marketing tools for textbooks. The only reason publishers do them is because the other publishers do them, and your teachers won't buy that textbook if it doesn't have a very large test bank. And the more the questions, the better. Sometimes publishers will attempt to do a little bit more sophisticated things with these than you might, but they might try to classify them as factual or critical thinking, or they might have assess their difficulty, but this is typically not true. Who does these tests? The publishers hire out somebody to write all the items, and they get paid for writing a number of items, and apparently for not much else. And so again, we're back to the same old problem, is we've got a lot of items, but the way they were constructed and the way that they connect back to what's important in the learning objectives, we don't really know. So let's look at some of the, first of all, let's look at this is the anatomy of a multiple choice question here. We're gonna use these terms. So there's the question stem, and then all of our A, B, C, and D, those are options. Then there's one, which most teachers will call the correct answer, but it's interesting. There is a website for an organization called FAIR Test, which I highly recommend to you. They don't call it the correct answer. They call it the wanted answer. It's the answer that the teacher wants the students to give. Some might doubt whether it's actually correct or not. And then those that aren't the correct answer are the distractor. So here's some recommendations. Base each item on a learning outcome. Obviously, that goes back to our total learning package issue. So when you have an item on a quiz, if it isn't related to a learning outcome, then it's a random item, and students will not know to look for it. Students are guided, at least to the extent that we let them be, in looking, reading, based on what we told them they should learn. And if the item doesn't reflect the learning outcome, then they would have had no way to know that would have been something on a quiz. And so we're back to the just test and the learning objective ideas. Minimize the amount of reading. This is especially a problem because reading speed is not something that you're testing. You're testing the knowledge of geography of the Middle East. You're not testing reading speed. And so the more the reading, the more you are inadvertently and unavoidably introducing the concept of reading speed, and perhaps also speed of comprehension. And those two things are related but different. So minimize the amount of reading. Be sensitive to cultural and language issues. You can see examples of poorly written items that actually use idiomatic English rather than just plain straightforward English. Words like to come up with. Well, I mean, we all know what that means, right? It means that you've gone diving, found something, and brought it to the surface, right? Well, if you're not a first language speaker of English, then you might not know that. This is actually a really good one. It's a very concrete one that you can look at an item and you can say, is this true or not? The question should be meaningful without having to read all the options first. The stem ought to be a coherent, meaningful question. If the student has to read all the options before she can know what the question is, that's a good example of having introduced irrelevant cognitive load. that's a back and forth cognition process that takes away from the time and the attention the student can focus on actually answering the question.
Yeah, they're looking for the right option.
Yeah.
When they start on the options, they're looking
for the right one. They know the right one. That process of looking back at the stem, looking at the answer, trying to make the stem fit to the answer, that's all wasted cognitive effort, unrelated to assessing the thing that you want to assess. State the stem in positive rather than negative terms. Now, there's a generalization we can make about this, and that is that any question or distractor that has a negative of any kind in it, you should probably fix. Because all negation requires an extra cognitive step, and that step would hardly ever be relevant to answering the question. It's just a step. Keep vocabulary consistent and familiar, and what I mean by familiar here is you'll see sometimes test items, and again, the teacher might do this or it might come from a test bank, where there's a vocabulary word that's in the question that a typical student might not know, but that isn't in the book. So if the vocabulary word is part of what a student ought to know, well, then that's part of the question. But to the extent that there's vocabulary in the question, which is irrelevant to the answer, but that the student might not know, now you're back to measuring something that isn't what you intended to measure. Now you're measuring vocabulary level. And you're also back to the unjust test, because vocabulary levels are very tied to educational experience and socioeconomic status. Keep options parallel in the format, make them a similar length. In the test wiseness thing, one of the first giveaways to which the answer is the right one is that it's the longest one. Include most information in the stem so the options can be short. Again, this is cognitive load related. Avoid tricking test takers. There are some faculty who put trick questions on the test, and I'll just be blunt about it. That's just an abuse of power. That's really all you can characterize that, because if the trick isn't knowing the real answer to the question, then that's an unfair request. And you can only get by with that because you have the power to get by with that. And that's the essential definition of injustice, is people abuse their power because they can. So difficult questions, that's totally legitimate. But a question you have to figure out the answer to by knowing something other than the answer, that's not a legitimate question. Okay. So, distractors. This is a long list. It's longer than it should be on the slide, but I thought I'd just get them all on here. So, after you've done a stem that meets the characteristics that we just talked about, the distractors are actually the really core part of your test. They are what makes it difficult or not, and they are what makes it. The distractors both govern the discrimination factor as well as the difficulty factor. Okay, and you can manipulate both the difficulty and the discrimination capacity of your test by manipulating the distractors in a thoughtful way. So, first of all, you have to do distractors based on what you know are common student errors. In psychology, we have things called operant conditioning and classical conditioning. And in classical conditioning, there's conditioned stimulus and conditioned response, and unconditioned stimulus, unconditioned response. And there's negative reinforcement and positive reinforcement in the operant mode. And it is just virtually guaranteed that students will confuse negative reinforcement and punishment. That's an obvious distractor. Base distractors on common student errors. One of the reasons for doing that is because that actually gives you some diagnostic capacity with your test. You can tell, okay, did they get that common problem or did they not get it, and do I need to go work on it some more? Another strategy for making good distractors is to make sure the distractors are true statements, but not the answer. This makes a really good distractor because you don't, you know, it's easier to tell a potentially untrue statement, and then if it's an untrue statement, it can't possibly be the right answer. So true statements that are not the answer are good sources for distractors. Not absolute statements. No never, no always, no all. This is pretty common sense, but it's, again, it's on the test wiseness dimension. The answers should be different. The distractors should be different in substance, not just subtle details from the correct answer. They should be different in ways that reflect the meaningfulness in your learning outcomes. That's the way to understand this. If to make the distinction between answer A and answer B is part of a learning outcome, then it's fair game. But if to make the distinction between A and B really isn't something that you intended for students to need to know, then that's just a subtle difference that's not a good distractor. To do that will increase your difficulty level and decrease your discrimination level. So it'll be a more difficult question that both good and poor performers on the test will both miss. And that's not what you want. Avoid all of the above and none of the above. Now, there's a different reason for each one of those. You want to avoid all of the above because as soon as they identify one of the above, they know that that's not the right answer. So it's a test wiseness thing. None of the above creates the same problem I just described earlier. There's a lot of research on this. So this is a research-based observation. When you have none of the above as an option, you increase the overall difficulty of the question, but reduce its discrimination ability. So more people get it wrong, but it doesn't make better students stand out. Item will be missed by more students. It will be missed equally by students who scored well on the test and students who scored poorly on the test. And again, that's not the kind of item that tells you anything that you need to know. And it also is not the kind of item which I think we would call just in putting a grade on a student, because it doesn't reflect what the student knows. If it's a one-item quiz and it has higher difficulty and lower discrimination, it's by definition unfair because you're giving a person a grade based on a test item which really doesn't distinguish between what they know and what they don't know, which is the point of the test, right? Okay, so I want to go back to the sausage making. Why is it that we see so many, and we do see so many, test item files, test banks, teacher-made tests that use all of the above, none of the above, always, never? Why is it that we see such a high frequency of these kinds of what I'm going to characterize as errors? Why do we see test items that are poorly written, that have options of multiple links, or that don't have parallel formats, or don't pay attention to vocabulary? Why do we see so many of those kinds of mistakes in both test banks and teacher-made tests? What do you think?
It takes a lot of time to not make those mistakes.
Exactly. It takes a lot of time. So I want to deal with a couple of big picture questions here. First of all, does it matter? I'm sure some folks would argue, well, you know, it just doesn't really matter. You just give a quiz and you're done with it and that's fine. So I think actually it does. To the extent that students don't see assessment as related to what they were supposed to learn, they just don't learn. And so I think it does matter from a learning outcome perspective. And I think it actually matters from a justice perspective, because poorly designed tests differentially harm people who are lower socioeconomic status, whose English is not their first language, a whole range of folks who don't deserve to be harmed just because the teacher can't be bothered to spend enough time working on the test. Ultimately, you only know when a multiple choice test item is a good item after you've given it and evaluated it. You can't really tell just by looking. So yeah, I mean, you can get a start. You can see about these criteria here and make sure the test items fit the do's and don'ts. And you'll have a good running start. But back to the problem of time. There is actually a way to get decent multiple choice items without spending all that time writing the items yourself. And that is to go ahead and use test bank items, but then evaluate them for yourself and pick the good ones to use the next time. And that's a really much more efficient, much faster way of getting high quality items that you can really depend on. But how you really know a test item is a good item is by looking at some very simple statistical numbers. Percent correct, and this little thing, item difficulty or item discrimination index, is really very simple. It can be that your very best allies in writing good multiple choice items are the students who just took the items. Because they will tell you, I didn't understand that. They will give you all kinds of great insight to those items. And so I really like the idea of giving a multiple choice test and then looking at the items. I mean, every test ought to have some items on it that everybody gets right.
Why?
For morale purposes. So, and your items should be, once you know the difficulty index, the items should be organized on the test from least to most difficult to maximize
just
the student's cognitive.
Oh, yeah,
to maximize the student's cognitive. Two or three easy questions at the beginning.
Give a little confidence.
Builds the student's confidence.
Yeah.
They also set a framework for how these items are going to be working, and you want the later items to kind of be a similar format, and so they can easily kind of get the pattern. Once you have the difficulty number, you can just pick items, and the test average will be whatever you make it. I mean, if you've got test items that, you know, maybe 50 students have done, and you have the difficulty index for it, you can make a test that'll have an average grade of 40 or 80, whatever you want, just by manipulating the difficulty of the items that you put on the test. So it makes, you know, it makes planning the test and having sense that it's what you expect the outcome to be. So I like to give, well, now, I should have made this disclosure earlier. I have not given a multiple choice test that counted for a grade in memory. I mean, like 20 years, probably not since I've come to ACU. And I'm reevaluating my thinking about that. There's some research that's very interesting about it. But when I did use multiple choice tests, I would give the test, I would do the numbers, and then I would pick out the ones that to me puzzled me about why more students missed it than I would have expected. And I would say, all right, tell me about this question. You know, and I would then find out about it.